Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. From the beginning of the pandemic, there was concern about how stay-at-home orders would impact children. A constant thread throughout COVID-19 has been understanding the toll, if any, remote learning would have on students, followed by passionate debates about the best way to balance public health while reducing harm. We've had a good number of these types of conversations on Inside because the issue of mental health and social isolation is far from a fixed topic. It does evolve, and it often involves a lot of anecdotes of personal experiences. But researchers are continuing to learn more and better understand how varied the consequences of the pandemic can be. A new study looked at a specific age group, teens between 14 and 16 years of age. Researchers looked at how in-person learning versus hybrid or fully remote shaped high schoolers' mental health and their overall experience with school, as well as their academic performance. Drew Singel is an associate professor at UC Davis and lead author of the study, and joins us now with how teens were impacted by online learning during COVID-19. Good morning, Drew. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Let's start off with your academic background and what led to this research.
So we found, I had a conversation with my colleagues, and we realized that because of the disparity in how the states and the country overall approached online learning or approached the pandemic and schooling for adolescents, that we had conducted, in effect, a natural experiment where some adolescents were attending school in person, some were in a hybrid model, some were online. It differed by state, it differed by school district, it differed within families. And so we started to think, what impact would that have on these three groups of adolescents? Would they come out of the pandemic at the same level in terms of their feelings about school and mental health, or would there be differences as a function of differences in schooling?
What led to narrowing down to 14 and to 16-year-olds?
Because that age, social development is so important at that age. That sense of social connection, forming groups, forming friendships, maintaining those friendships. Because it's so important at that age, we thought that taking adolescents out of school, being in online learning, would cut out those social connections that they so desperately need at that time.
Yeah. And you also added another layer. You included and accounted for gender identity, including those who identify as transgender, as well as gender nonconforming. What went into accounting for gender identity as opposed to other demographics?
Sure. There are also differences in mental health with gender identity. And adolescents who identify as transgender or gender nonconforming oftentimes aren't focused on in research to begin with. And when they are, the research shows that they also tend to struggle in terms of their feelings about school and mental health. So we wanted to account for that in this study.
So how did you go about conducting this survey?
We were fortunate to receive funding from the Susan Crown Exchange and were able to conduct a national sample of adolescents using a Qualtrics panel. And we were able to survey a little over 1,200 adolescents across the United States.
What went into formulating the questions?
It was a really broad overview. We knew that the pandemic had affected every aspect of human life, certainly of adolescent life. And so we wanted to account for that in some small way in the survey by focusing on their media use, by focusing on their feelings about school, their sense of social connection, and their mental health.
So you obviously went into this research, you know, with an inkling at least that there is a problem that you wanted to better understand. But did the findings surprise you? Any of the findings surprise you?
These are some of the most surprising findings of any research I've conducted, simply in that we showed that online learning had exhibited a difference in adolescence across every single variable that we measured. Adolescents in online learning relative to their peers who were in a hybrid model or who were in person felt they were more negative about school. They felt that their schoolwork was less meaningful. They experienced a greater drop in grades. They felt less satisfied with their sense of social connection. They increased in terms of pathological or addictive media use, and their mental health was worse.
Yeah, you're probably what you are confirming are a lot of feelings that people have within households over the last 2.5 years, going from anecdotes to actually quantitative research and findings. You also looked at these four categories: loneliness, social anxiety, depression, and anxiety. Now, it was higher for hybrid and virtual learners, as well as those who identify as transgender and gender nonconforming. But overall, I mean, what I'm hearing for you is that the numbers overall were concerning because they look that way to me, even with my unresearcher eye.
Yeah, it's rare when you study humans, when you study adolescents in particular, for the pattern in the data to be so consistent. Usually you find that maybe online learners would be worse off in just anxiety, for example. But that just wasn't the case here. It was across the board, every aspect that we measured, they were just doing worse. Coming out of the pandemic, this was in the spring of 2021.
Were you surprised that it also included hybrid learning as well as virtual remote learning? That was hybrid learning a buffer at all when compared to fully in person to fully online?
Actually, yes. And that was an interesting finding from this. In most cases, there was no difference between adolescents who were in person and hybrid, which would indicate to me that simply by being in person 2 or 3 days a week, that was enough of a buffer, enough of a protective factor for those adolescents so that their data didn't look like those of the adolescents who were in completely virtual learning.
The research also included a component of social media, and that includes video gaming as well. And what I found interesting was that in the report, it said that social media can be a protective mechanism in response to online learning during the pandemic. And I think often when we think of social media, we think of it, you know, overall as negative with some silver linings. But how can social media be a protective mechanism when we can't physically be with each other?
Sure. Our thinking on that was that if you take adolescents out of their normal social context, that perhaps, hopefully, they can account for that in some way through their media use. And anecdotally, and the data support this as well, social video gaming increased quite dramatically among adolescents during the pandemic, where they couldn't get together with their friends, but they could play video games together and still communicate synchronously through those video games. Or they could use social media to hang out with their friends in some sort of way, watch the same videos together, communicate fairly synchronously. And the data we see some support for that in the data, that adolescents in virtual learning context were able to use media to socially connect with their friends.
But it also did fall short. When does it veer into problematic or counterproductive use?
Sure. We accounted for problematic or what we call pathological use when media use causes conflict with parents, conflict with siblings, when it cuts into the time an adolescent can spend sleeping, when they struggle to turn off the device and use it in a pathological or addictive way.
Mm. When looking at video gaming and more broadly social media, are they distinctive or are they kind of, or did you kind of lump them in together in terms of the impact it could have on teenagers?
We looked at them separately, but what we found is that the relationships were fairly similar. That pathological video game use or pathological social media use is associated with poor mental health outcomes among adolescents, and media use for social connection can, in some cases, be associated with better mental health outcomes for adolescents.
I mean, as a parent or just in a space where you take care of children, even at school, how do you want them to think about this research?
What I think it points out is that if you are a parent or a supportive adult in the life of an adolescent who is in online learning, or an adolescent who identifies as transgender or gender nonconforming, we have these two groups of adolescents, at least in spring of 2021, that were quantitatively doing worse than their peers who were in hybrid and in online, hybrid and in-person learning. And I think it's important to check in with your adolescents and understand that that's the experience that they had, that's where they are, and check in and see where they are now. We're still trying to understand the length that these effects may go. We're not sure if adolescents in online learning in 2021, now that we're back in person, if they've risen back up to the same level of their peers. But it's important to check in if you're at home with your adolescent and see how they're doing, see how their mental health is. Check in on their media use. Make sure that they're not using media before bed, because that cuts into sleep time and that has a negative effect on mental health as well.
Yeah, that's good advice for adults as well, myself included.
Absolutely, yes.
You know, given that you really honed in on gender identity as well, what were the big takeaways when looking at students who identify as transgender or gender nonconforming?
It's a very similar story to the adolescents who were in online learning. Adolescents who identify as transgender or gender nonconforming compared to adolescents who identify as male or female, felt significantly worse about school. They felt less connected socially. They experienced worse mental health and they were significantly higher in media use and particularly pathological media use.
How do you want teenagers to understand what they might be going through?
I think it's important to know that they are hurt, that I think when we I always think that when we were making these decisions, it was the adults making decisions for adolescents, and that's typical. But we now know that at some point we need to take adolescents' voices into account. And that's what we were trying to do in this survey, to understand from what their experience was so that we can now work with them to help them to grow and thrive as we move through the pandemic.
You know, your research highlights or just confirms an issue that has been talked about since the onset of the pandemic. But in terms of solutions, what do you think can be done? What recommendations do you have?
I think that, again, understanding that we have these two groups of adolescents who are quantitatively different from other adolescents, and understanding that we can have support for these adolescents in school, making sure that if your school was in online learning for an extended period of time, that supports need to be in place. Resources need to go to these kinds of schools. Schools that have transgender, gender non-conforming populations. These are adolescents that we can target with interventions to help them reach the same level of their other peers.
Drew, thank you so much for the research and for taking time to share it with us.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Drew Singel is an associate professor at UC Davis and lead author of a study about how teenagers, specifically 14 to 15 and 16-year-olds, were impacted by online learning during COVID-19. Up next, the Public Policy Institute of California, PPIC, joins us with their annual report on the state of California's water and really the difficult decisions to thrive with less. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Today, we turn the calendar to December, and storms arriving to the region seem to signal a promising start for snowfall to ease California's prolonged drought. But for now, the overall outlook is not optimistic. Federal climate scientists at NOAA have forecasted a warmer and drier than average winter for California and the broader Western United States. And according to the U.S. Drought Monitor, much of the state is experiencing severe to exceptional drought conditions. All of this suggests California could be in for another year with less water. So what can Californians expect in the upcoming years as our climate's future becomes more uncertain? Here to help us answer those questions and explain how California can thrive with less is Jeffrey Mount, a senior fellow with the nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California, PPIC. Jeffrey, welcome back to Insight. Nice to see you.
Actually, nice to see you in person.
I know.
What
it's wonderful. I know. We actually met in person for the first time. It's
That's
wonderful.
Right.
We were just talking about how we're talking about thriving with less water at a time when we have decent systems moving through our area this week. But things like this really are a drop in the bucket when it comes to the longstanding issues of California's climate and how it's becoming more unpredictable.
Right. We have a tendency to focus on the now. It's raining outside and it's cold and it's snowing. It's delightful. It's a drop in the bucket. And this is a really vanilla storm. We really need those frog chokers that we expect in the winter, those really big storms with the atmospheric rivers to bust this.
And kind of touching upon that is your report included an excerpt from John Steinbeck's East of Eden. And the quote is, "During the dry years, the people forget about the rich years. And when the wet years returned, they lost all memory of the dry years, and it was always that way." Does it seem to be it's always that way now?
Yeah, the modern version is the disaster memory half-life is short. We forget. And that's just human nature, except the people like us who are in the trenches working on this stuff all the time.
Right. You are knee deep into being a water policy expert.
Good metaphor.
Yeah. How far does this annual report go back?
So we've been doing this report in this current form about 5 years, but elements of it go back as much as 9 or 10 years. So on our website, you can look at the historic ones. You can track our changes in our opinions and our observations over the years by looking at it on our website.
You know, given that we've had years-long conversations locally about water challenges and California's increasingly unpredictable climate swings, what is the main headline for this year's annual report?
So the key is that there's an elephant in the room that we dance around all the time, because that's what you do when you've got an elephant in the room. And that is, we are looking at a future in which there's likely to be less available water. I mean available for supply to the three key sectors, which is communities, farms, and the environment. So we're looking at basically how to thrive with less. And the argument we make in this report is we can. In fact, we have. There's plenty of evidence that we have. We're still here. We've added 10 million people since 1980, and we're still using the same amount of water we were back then. So we can adapt to this thing, and these changes. But to be clear, we're not looking at more available supply.
Given that you have been really studying this for nearly a decade, how has the purpose of compiling these annual reports on the state of California's water, how has it evolved along with the climate challenges over those years?
And that's what you've hit it in a nutshell. Climate has become increasingly a more important, if not central, theme in these reports, because it's here. Climate change was viewed and is still viewed by most people as something that's happening in the future. It's not. It's here. It's here now. We're seeing its effects, particularly during drought, where we're seeing these warmer, drier droughts. So things have changed. And that should change your outlook for the future and your actions today.
Yeah. You know, given that you go back to like 2017 when we had, you know, a very high water year, and then obviously what happened up in Butte County at Oroville at the spillway. But then you have that compounded with back-to-back years of drought-like conditions. You know, when it comes to looking at the state of the water, how has that changed over just the last 5 years, going back to 2017 to now in 2020?
Well, okay, so that's a great illustration of something that the climate scientists were predicting 15, 20 years ago, is that we were going to see changes in conditions where we'd have wild swings between wet and dry, wetter wets and drier dries. Our whole water supply infrastructure system is built around basically the climate of the mid-20th century. So this is a new thing for us to deal with. 2017 broke our biggest water supply structure for the State Water Project at Oroville. 2012 and 2016 broke our groundwater system. And this latest drought really broke our surface water system. What I think people forget is 2021 was a miserable year. Mm-hmm. I mean, absolutely miserable year. We consumed 100% of the water that ran off the watershed in the Central Valley. None of it made it to the ocean. Instead, we had to rely on reservoirs to keep the delta fresh enough so we could use it. Forget the environment for a second. That's how dire things were in 2021. So we've been breaking things for the last 10 years is the best way to describe it. And in the process of breaking things, we're finding out weaknesses in our systems that we need to address if we're going to cope with these wild swings between wetter wets and drier dries.
And when talking about drought, California isn't alone to drought struggles. On November 1st, like a month ago, the U.S. Drought Monitor found, I think, about 85% of the continental United States to be abnormally dry or mm-hmm. in a state of drought. How does that impact California?
So actually, this is one of the things that people in Sacramento forget, that we're tied to a grid. That's the best way to describe it. Think of it like the electricity grid that we have in California. We are part of a large grid that serves most of the people in the state. And that includes the whole Colorado River Basin. So all of the 7 states that are part of the Colorado River Basin. And the mega drought, which is a phrase that always makes us wince when we hear it, but that's what we call it, the mega drought, has spilled over into California. I mean, in the last 10 years, we've only had 2 wet years. Mm-hmm. You know, that's pretty grim when you think about it. Well, that's what it's been like for the last 22 years in the Southwest. And if you live in L.A., which is the economic engine of California, and you can't forget that, you are heavily reliant on the Colorado River for supply. And things are looking pretty dire in the Colorado. I can't sugarcoat it. That 22 years of dry conditions is really coming to bite.
Yeah, I can't help but think of, we're talking about mega drought, and the last time you joined us, we were analyzing a forecasted or projected mega flood in the coming decades. And I think that really, on a macro level, encompasses these dramatic pendulum swings.
Yeah, and also remember that most of the time we really compartmentalize the way we manage water. We got sort of drought-focused management, and completely different agencies and organizations are on the flood management side. So what's been happening over the last 10 years, with credit to California and the federal government and local agencies, they're really trying to merge these two. One of the key themes of this particular report that we gave is that we really do have to do a better job of taking advantage of these rare, very wet periods. Because if we don't take advantage of those, we suffer in between much more than we need to. So wet year strategies are as critical as dry year strategies.
What needs to improve with storage? Because because there's a lot that needs to improve with storage,
right,
especially in wet years, and we can't retain all of it.
That's right. And there's always the what we call the gray infrastructure people who want us to build dams everywhere. Well, you can't afford it. I mean, the problem, there's a cost associated, both an environmental cost and an economic cost associated with lots of new big construction. And we've built dams in all the good spots in California. So now you have sort of marginal spots. And if you can't fill it, it doesn't do you any good. So we have to sort of steer away from that and focus on our big reservoir and our big place where you can put water is groundwater. We have emptied more than 100 million acre feet of water, which is basically 2.5 times what we use in a year here in California. We have emptied that space in our groundwater basins. We need to start finding better ways to refill that.
There's also been discussion about desalination. I mean, mm-hmm. Where does that fit into the conversation?
Desalination is expensive. Let's just make it clear. And it tends to have a significant cultural and environmental impact. I mean that. I mean, people say, why doesn't LA just get off the Delta and use desal as their approach? Well, it would take a huge plant every 5 miles along the coast of Southern California to do such a thing. Do you think the folks in Malibu are going to go for that? I don't think so. So desal will always be important at the margins. San Diego gets 5 to 7% of its supply from that very large desalination plant. And that doesn't sound like much, but it's really important during droughts, during periods of shortage. So we're always going to see, I think we're going to see more desal, but we're likely to see in small amounts and in places where it's brackish water, like Antioch, at the base of the Delta, where it costs a lot less to basically clean up the water and make it usable for drinking.
And in the meantime, I mean, we're dealing with conditions that even in the report you found are once hard to imagine. How does this trickle down or trickle up to water managers?
Well, so this is, I think, the sort of the great awakening throughout California. When I first got into this business, we relied entirely on historic conditions as a predictor of the future. And what has changed throughout the system now is that the future is very uncertain. And in fact, I think, thanks to really good quality science that's being done in our universities and labs and in the federal government in particular, we can see what the future looks like. And there's no longer denying it. We're now starting to adapt to it. And I think that's the big sea change over the last 10 years. And you can thank the 2012-2016 drought as sort of triggering all of that. Policymakers, scientists, everybody said, okay, it's here. It's time to adapt.
Yeah, you have the picture of Governor Jerry Brown walking on just a dry flat of land that typically up in Phillips Station should be inundated with snow for snow surveys. When it comes down to individual use residents that live in the state, we've been asked to conserve water at a lot of regions across California. But you said that California communities essentially use the same amount of water that they did as back in the late 1980s, despite our population growing. So about, 10 million people in that time?
Yep.
So is water conservation on an individual level still really important if the use has stayed stagnant with a population growth?
So as we discovered this year and during this particular drought, this 3-year drought, there's still room for conservation. I mean, and you know that every time you drive through a community, particularly in the Sacramento area, and you see vast lawns.
Yeah.
I mean, right there. I mean, for your last interview, my suggestion was kill your television. Jerry Brown would say, kill your lawn. Okay, so half of the water use that we have in urban areas goes to outdoor irrigation. So we still have some room to adapt in terms of conservation. But there are areas in the state where there isn't a lot of room left to adapt. Those are the places that don't have large lawns, that don't have a lot of landscaping. And they have wrung almost as much water as they can out of their system through conservation. So that's the challenge, is we just basically get what you can call hardened demand. I mean, at some point, we've wrung all the water we can out of that system. So we're going to need some other approaches. And to the credit, throughout, particularly in urban areas in California, there is a lot of innovation going on and a lot of investment of money in it. I mean, in Southern California, stormwater reuse and recapture, recycling of wastewater, lots of putting water into groundwater basins. Some really smart stuff is being done. This is why I'm actually optimistic, which is not my style, I suppose, as a scientist. Sometimes we become cynical about this stuff. But no, actually, I'm optimistic that smart people are making smart investments. And the future is, we're not going to dry up and blow away, much to the chagrin of the New York Times.
Well, when it comes to the investment, just a little dig there. But when it comes to, you know, the solutions that we're talking about, and with water is not immune from inequity. And especially when you look at the Central Valley, there are low-income communities that struggle for access just to clean, safe water. What solutions are taking shape?
So again, this is one of those places where we used to just talk about it, and now we're actually starting to do stuff about it. And it helps that there's money available. This is one of the problems that can be solved with money. This is drilling new wells. This is connecting wells to larger, deeper wells. This involves consolidation of these small community systems, which are woefully inefficient. There's a variety of things that can be done. So I'm actually... we're headed in the right direction. We've got a long way to go on equity in these communities. But I want to say that the other equity issue we often don't talk about a third of urban California are people who are low income. And to solve our water supply systems, we're going to have to make a lot of investments. More than 90% of what we spend on water in California comes from ratepayers. And these are the people who are paying rates. So the equity discussion needs to include people in the cities as well as these rural communities, these disadvantaged rural communities. So that is a larger conversation that's going on all over the place right now. And I think it's very healthy.
Yeah. Heading up to the state, to Del Norte County and Humboldt County along the Klamath River, I mean, something is taking shape that has been years or even decades in the making, and that's the removal of four dams along the Klamath River. I visited the Yurok tribe this summer, and they talked at length about it. And this is pretty historic. It's going to be the largest demolition project in the country's history. What does this signify? Why is this important, removing four dams up in the northwestern corner of our state?
So there's two perspectives on this. One is, let's just talk about this most simple tribal justice question. I mean, those tribes that on the North Coast have been connected to that river. Every aspect of their culture is tied to that river and the salmon that run up and down the river. The removal of these four hydropower dams, which have no impact on flood control, no impact on water supply whatsoever, but in fact are a major impediment to migration of salmon into the upper watershed where there's good habitat for spawning. This is a big deal, particularly for the tribes. It's also a big deal nationally and internationally. This is the largest river restoration program in the history of the United States. Nothing comes close, and arguably in the world. So all eyes are on this, especially because there's a lot of uncertainties of what's going to happen when you take these four dams out. But I do want to caution, that doesn't solve the problem of the Klamath Basin, because most of these fish spawn in tributaries. And so we still have to focus on the conditions in the tributaries, but at least now they can get to the tributaries.
Finally, in the last minute that we have, I mean, the purpose of these annual reports going back, you know, 9 or 10 years, they go into the hands of lawmakers and to people who can actually make change. And you're optimistic about the outlook for California's water year. When have you seen the report and the research that you're doing lead to really kind of fundamental policy changes that impact daily lives for Californians?
And my people who work on this kind of stuff will be very sympathetic. You never can say, I caused that to happen. I mean, our report caused X to happen. But we have noticed that some of the language of our historic reports are starting to appear in all kinds of places, like, for example, the governor's water supply strategy. I mean, that's kind of like right out of some of our reports. So whether we are the cause of it or we just enabled it, we never really know. But it's worth making these kinds of investments so that people can get, particularly, you know, we often target legislators and their staff and the governor's office and folks like that. So they've got a simple way to understand a problem and to see what the solutions are.
Well, thank you, Jeffrey, for joining us to simplify a very complicated problem.
And let me finish by saying support Capital Public Radio, as my wife and I do every month. It's a pledge drive. There, I put in my plug for you guys.
We're about to head to more a fun drive.
I know that.
Jeffrey Mount is a senior fellow with the Public Policy Institute of California, PPIC, sharing their report on California's water priorities for next year and beyond. You're listening to Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The holiday season is upon us. Lights are up, the leaves are falling, and the weather today is just perfect for that warm cup of tea and your favorite fuzzy sweater. Mine looks like it looks like Christmas candy right now. Add to that the sounds of the season. And that gets us to our next guest. Next week, the Sophia Theater is holding a special event with the work of renowned artist Pasquale Esposito. Take a listen.
It's the most wonderful time of the year, with the kids jingle belling and everyone telling you be of good cheer. It's the most wonderful time of the year. It's the happiest season.
That is the Italian tenor's version of It's the Most Wonderful Time of Year from his album called In the Spirit of Christmas. And next Friday, December 9th, he will perform his holiday favorites along with an original composition at the Sofia, accompanied by the San Jose State Orchestra. Pasquale Esposito joins us ahead of his performance here in Sacramento. Welcome to Insight, Pasquale.
Buongiorno. It's the most wonderful time of the year. I love that.
I love that. I love you. Thank you. This is a great way to close our show. Before we get into next Friday's performance at the Sofia, you were here just back in April. You were on tour for a PBS special, Il Tempo, and now you're about to come back for your Christmas special. What do you like about performing in front of a Sacramento audience? Because it's just been a few months since we've seen you.
Sacramento audience is wants Pasquale more and more. It's like, and makes me incredibly happy. We are selling so well over there, almost sold out, and we're doing fantastic. And I think the Sacramento people are very attached to their roots. So going back to that marvelous Italian-American song, so going back to the season of Christmas where we get together with our family and everything and celebrate with the music, it's very special for them.
Yeah, given that you were born in Naples, Italy, you also immigrated to the United States in the late 1990s. You studied at San Jose State, and now the San Jose State Orchestra is going to be joining you next week. What is it about California, and specifically Northern California, that drew you here, and where you take inspiration?
Well, I was about 14 years old, and I was in Italy, and I was watching a television show called Baywatch. Just kidding. California
never
is a magical...
heard of it.
It was a magical place. So I was always in love with this place since I came the first time. I was very young, and at that point it was on University Avenue in Palo Alto that I applied for my green card, and I won the lottery. So I came back to California. I remember coming back to San Francisco without speaking one word in English. I know what you're thinking now. You still don't speak English.
Multiple languages.
I arrived to San Francisco on a very foggy day, and it was and since then has been a spectacular journey. And California has been home for me. I mean, I feel here the people, the connection, the fact that you are surrounded by people so open-minded, with so many cultures, so many style of living, and everybody getting together so well makes me proud to be an American and proud to be in California.
And you've just had such a successful and wonderful career that brings smiles to so many people's faces. How do you describe your style of music to those who haven't heard you before?
I'll define myself in pop opera artist. Even though I studied opera at San Jose State University, I took the route of a pop opera to appeal to more people, even though I perform with San Francisco Opera. But that will be the best definition. I am now in a production of a new CD that is going to be and little new Pasquale, because I'm experimenting some rock opera style. So I look forward to share that with all of you.
We're going to preview some of the music that you're going to be performing next week. Let's take a listen to O Holy Night. That is just wonderful. And you're going to be accompanied by the San Jose State Orchestra, conducted by Maestro Fred Cohen. Talk to us about your connection with the university, especially as an alum.
Yeah, it's very strong. When I was at the university, I always felt that I was getting an amazing training, but I was not getting the real stage performance. Training that can give you just the stage and the adrenaline of when there is an audience who paid a ticket and is out there and they demanding to see something special. And I feel that was a missing part of the component of my education that I was visioning at San Jose State University, even though it was a wonderful program and I got my degree in vocal performance, and I'm always thankful. So I was thinking how I can give back to my university. So I get in touch with them, with Dr. Cohen, who is going to conduct the university, and he's the musical director. And I was inviting them to perform with me around the country, and to give this young student the opportunity to feel what you feel before the 15 minutes, before the 10 minutes, when there is that call and you need to go and you need to perform. And believe me, I performed with orchestra all around the world, but with this young youth orchestra, and they vary in age, of course, you can feel like there is such a very special connection, a very special vibe that happens that makes the performance so special.
Yeah, I mean, what you're giving these students is something that is invaluable, and it can't be taught in a textbook by having that experience of a live performance. We're going to listen to another song, and this one is one that you have produced. It's an original, and it is called World With My Eyes.
Poi mio figlio mi raggiunge e mi fa vedere cose che non riesco più a vedere. È lui che mi apre gli occhi, mi dice:
albero. many cannot feel the Christmas in the earth. To them I want to tell how magical it is to view.
So you have a transition from Italian to English. Is that a signature style of yours? What was the inspiration for that? That was amazing.
I do that often, mixing language. So people are very intrigued about the Italian language. It sounds very romantic. And then, but at the end, they want to understand what are you saying. So I felt that the combination is always a winning. And I use that in many, many TV special and CDs and production. This song came about, unfortunately, I lost my mother about 5 years ago. And you know, when you lose someone such important, it was November 29, actually, a few days ago, I was just thinking about, it was the anniversary, the fifth year. And when you lose someone so important, you feel Christmas is not Christmas anymore. Mm-hmm. Until your little children take your hand and make you understand it is Christmas, that someone is about to be born, life goes on, and it's through them that you find the energy to move on and to celebrate life in general. So it's a reborn through the children. And this song, the title is The World With Your Eyes, because you see the Christmas through the eyes of children, and you discover through that you can move on. And life goes on, and you need to move on for them. So very important.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I mean, it's a new chapter after someone who is the nucleus and the heart of a family, you know, passes Absolutely. On. Pasquale, thank you so much for joining us, and we will welcome you to Sacramento next week.
Look forward to be there at Sofia Theater, a wonderful venue, so cozy, so perfect for celebrating together.
Pasquale Esposito is an Italian tenor, and he will be performing next Friday at the Sofia. We have all of that information on our Insight page. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you back here on Monday.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.